Setting up shop.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Setting Up Shop, your favorite podcast for those of you who are small business owners, maybe crafters, maybe hobbyists wanting to become small business owners, or just looking for tips to improve how to sell things at market, how to feel better about selling the things you're doing, and create networks and all of that kind of good stuff. But in a non-scary way, because we're three friendly people, we're doing it ourselves, we're not business experts trying to sell you the best get-rich-quick scheme. I'm just a wood turner from the UK, and with me as always are my friends Heidi, a potter from the States, and Erasmus, a blacksmith from Norway. How are you guys doing? There we go. Good. As always, we talk over each other in that particular segment because I get my timing wrong. This week, our episode is going to focus on teaching. So I think a lot of people at some point in their journey will certainly have been taught themselves or be self-taught, but also be asked, do you teach? Are you willing to share your knowledge, experience, etc.? And that can be a very daunting thing for some people, or it can be something that people go, oh yeah, that'd be great, and then jump straight into it with no thought, and can be a place where things don't go quite as well as you might have expected they would. You have a first attempt in learning, as one of my friends who used to be a headmaster says. It's not a failure, it's a first attempt in learning.
Sounds
Sounds kind of cool, but it came from a headmaster, so I instinctively didn't like it. I was just like, this feels a bit too, you know. But it is quite good, first attempt in learning. You've got to ask yourself, first question is, what's your motivation behind doing it? And regardless as to whether or not that motivation is money or not, the question should still remain after establishing your motivation is, should you do it?
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, I myself do teach. Rasmus teaches. I know you've been asked to teach and you've possibly taught in the past, but do you currently teach? I'm not quite sure.
Not on the regular. It's not something that's in my schedule right now, but I do teach on occasion.
Lovely. Okay, so if we consider that question then of should you teach, we've got to, let's go way back. Let's go way back to season one, episode one, and consider this conversation about turning your hobby into a business, where we spoke about establishing your timetable, working out your time slots, and exactly what you're going to use those for. By this point, if you haven't done that, this is another time to drag out that exercise and redo it. And maybe just focus on the time you allocate to working on your side hustle, hobby, whatever you call it, and then work out from that exactly how much time you do have for teaching. Because you've got to remember that time, whatever it is, whether it's an hour or up to a full day or whatever it is you're doing, is going to take time away from your production or your selling schedule. So you've got to think about that. That's your first, I would say, I don't know if you guys agree, but I would say that's your first point is, you know, how much time is it going to take away and what is the trade-off? So if you're getting into teaching because you think it's a good way to make money, then you've got to think, how long is it going to be? How much money can I make from that? Am I going to make more by spending the same amount of time producing or selling my product? That's a very corporate way of looking at it, but it can be a very, very productive thing to do right at the beginning. So Rasmus, why should you teach or shouldn't you teach? We'll cover both.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting one. Just because you want to share the craft with someone doesn't mean you're good at teaching it.
We'll cover that slightly later. The question is whether you should or not.
No, I'm building up to it. Because you will be bad at teaching the first time you do it, no matter how good you are after your craft. Teaching is a whole lot of skill level. And if you are not comfortable with being a bad teacher for a little while, and possibly having some students come away with a less than perfect experience, then maybe teaching isn't for you right now. But if you know that you're able to communicate the very basics of your craft while you are at a fairly high skill level, which is in itself a really difficult thing, then yeah, maybe you should give it a shot. If you have people who are interested, if there's a market for it. Because like, if you are doing some really obscure version of needle felting or something, and there is no one else that knows about it, then it could be really difficult to get students in. But then again, you also have zero competition because nobody else is doing your thing.
Yeah, good points. Good points. Definitely, have you ever been asked to do it? Like, if you're sat there and you've no one has ever spoken to you and said, well, do you teach? I don't know about you, Heidi, but I've always felt that if someone comes up to you and asks, do you teach the subject, and they've interacted with you a few times before, whether it's they've bought things or just know whatever, I take it as a bit of a compliment that mm-hmm. they feel like they would be willing and able to spend time with you personally and learn. What is that the same sort of feeling you've had, or am I just projecting directly onto you?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's a sign of flattery. You know, they like what you do, number one, and it's something that they're interested in emulating or learning how to do. The times that I have been asked to teach have been for small groups, a community center asking for a local artisan to show children an entry-level craft into, you know, pottery, that kind of thing. Like, it was an outreach kind of situation where they were just looking for who does the craft that they're wanting to showcase. So in that case, it probably wasn't so much about me as a person, but my craft and whether or not I had availability. I've had people come to me that just wanted the experience, you know, like a couple that wanted to have like an evening to throw and just have an experience together, maybe spend an hour. And there was no thought to, oh, well, I want to do this because I want to learn how to do this myself and continue doing it. And then I've had those people that have always wanted to do pottery and they wanted to see if they would actually enjoy doing it before they invested in a studio or whatever. So it's been a lot of different ways that people have approached me about it. But definitely, Dan, by far my favorite approach is I'm at a show and someone really likes what I'm doing and it like feeds my ego for sure. Yeah. Like they want to spend time with me. Oh, yeah. They think I'm cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that can be a good or a bad thing when you actually get to the teaching experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a, it is definitely complimentary. I think it does depend how much time they've spent around you. Like you say, I've had people in the past who have sort of, they've come along, they've barely glanced at what work you've done and they've just asked the question. Now, it might be that they already know about the craft of wood turning and they're looking for a teacher. And I happen to be the first one that they've physically met rather than seeing a name on the screen or whatever. Yeah. But I'm always a lot more hesitant in that regard. So currently I teach through my workplace. So the space I'm in is my workplace space. I'm doing a lot of those tonight. Say those three times first. Workplace space. And so there are limitations, but also things that I don't currently have. So in my own workshop at home, if we talk a little bit about this, you've got to think about the fact that if you're willing to teach, if you've maybe taught some family or friends, if you've established that you're willing and able to communicate the basics, as Rasmus said, and that's an important thing, is you're teaching the basics or giving a fun experience to do with your craft. The next thing you've got to consider is how much room do you actually have? Like, do you have the space in your workspace to offer that as a safe teaching environment? Because litigation is a thing. You know, someone who might come across as being perfectly lovely might walk into your workspace and an accident may happen despite your best interests, and then you could find yourself in a very awkward position. So for a brief summary, make sure that you're covered on your insurance. Make sure that you've got all the right stuff in there, you know, regarding fire and sharp things and trip hazards and all that kind of good stuff, which you should have anyway for your own safety. But it's then, do you physically have room? Going back to what I mentioned earlier, if your time slot for teaching, let's say it's an hour's teaching, that then leads on to, right, how many people can you fit into your workspace? If it's one person and it's for an hour, that's then going to have an implication later on when we start thinking about pricing and comparative pricing to other people offering a similar thing. Obviously, if you can fit more people in the workspace and it's something like just getting hands-on with clay and getting a bit messy without needing a wheel, that's potentially more profitable, but it's also got a higher likelihood of accidents to happen because there is a limitation for how many people you can keep an eye on. I teach a maximum of 5 people on one of my courses. I wouldn't be willing to teach more than that, but I've also got the limitation of the fact that there's only 5 lathes in the training room. there is a quite well-known Irish woodturner who's got 8 lathes in his teaching space. And he's been teaching for many more years than I have and highly skilled. And, you know, he feels comfortable and able to teach 8 people at once. Fantastic. So it will take a little while to know your level, but your starting point is very much what is the physical space you've got and how willing are you to teach that group that is going to fit in there. And then there's a really, really, really important one in this. Are you patient? Are you a patient person? Are you able to stand in front of someone, whether it's on an individual or a group setting, who is potentially not someone you would personally spend time with and you would find quite a boring person to spend time with, but they have paid money to spend time with you and you, and they are just one of those people who takes a bit longer to understand a concept that you find very easy to do. And you will have to be prepared to find different ways of teaching that concept without getting frustrated yourself and without the person you're teaching getting frustrated, and witness them continuously making the same mistakes and not doing the things that you're telling them to do. And I don't know about you, Raz, but I've certainly seen this as I was helped to understand this by a couple of people, that if someone is consistently doing the same thing wrong and you haven't changed the way you're teaching them, then it's your fault as the teacher. It's not the student's fault. You haven't understood the way that they are, the way they learn and the way their brain processes things. So something I found helpful for this, and I don't know if you do the same, Raz, but we'll chat about that in just a second, but I found that initial conversation at the beginning of a teaching session, chatting about what they do as a job, any other hobbies they may have, I find really helpful to help myself understand. If, for instance, we get a lot of engineers in wood turning, I'm able to sort of explain a lot more and go, okay, they're heavy on the detail. They want the detail. They want the intimate understanding, particularly mechanical engineers anyway. They want the complete understanding of why they are doing a process and what impact that has on something else. So you can explain to them the whole thing from tool control, stance. You know, you can start using descriptive terms such as feed rate, even though you're talking about how quickly you're moving a tool along the thing by hand. But you can use all of that kind of terminology. Whereas someone who's a school teacher, a lot of that information is going to be more gibberish to them. So I adapt the way that I use analogy or things like that to them. Is that something you've experienced as well?
Yeah, I'm terrible at learning or like making it a point to learn about other people. I end up doing it during lunch because like we're sitting down, we're having a chat. It's nice to have a bit of a break from all of the forging and that side of it and to get to know each other a little bit better. But before that, generally speaking, I might not even feel like I have the time to spend a lot of time getting to know these people. Often enough, I have an email conversation with every single student before they're coming. They might tell me about their experience. They might tell me they did some metalwork back in school 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, that's a common thing.
they might have said like, oh, I worked in a metalworking trade just after college and things like that. So more often than not, I have a vague understanding of the people coming in, but also just from experience. And I just to that point, I teach about 6 students every single time. That's sort of the comfortable max of my space. I have room for a bit more. I have enough anvils, but it starts to get cramped. It starts to go a bit more on the waving glowing steel in someone's face side of things, which we try to keep at a minimum.
Yeah.
But I, as you were talking, I was starting to think like, what do I do to this? Because like, I know I do something. And I think I've just gotten into the habit of, I try to explain every single concept twice in 2 different ways.
Okay.
And because I am teaching the same curriculum more or less every single time, I have 2 different classes that I teach often. And then I have a handful of others that come in when there's interest for them. So I have ended up developing sort of this rhythm and style and the way of talking about these things that just seems to work for 90, 95% of the attendance.
Yeah. And how long have you been teaching?
8 years now, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think our first class, I think I taught my first class in 2016.
Yeah. Makes a difference, doesn't it? So just for point of view for the listeners, I totally understand what Raz is saying. And some of you may have experienced the same. Finding rhythms and mannerisms in which you teach and the same syllabus in which you teach and trying to make it still interesting and exciting for them. Because although you're passionate about something and it's good to cover the basics, there will always be some sections that you can find a little bit boring. And you've got to make sure you don't skip over that or teach it in a way that makes it sound like it's not important because you're fed up teaching it.
Yeah.
And these are the traps. These are the things that, Raz has been teaching for 8 years. I've been teaching for probably 3 or 4 now, maybe even be 5. I can't quite remember. And there are certain
amounts. You taught us your first class, was it?
I didn't start teaching until at least a year after that.
Okay, because that was 2019, I think.
Yeah, so 2019, you guys were the first. So for those of you not aware, Rasmus, Heidi, and a bunch of others came round to my workplace. It was all prearranged, and I was teaching for my first ever lesson of teaching people. I was teaching 10 students at 2 to a lathe, and wasn't entirely sure what I was teaching. Oh, and we only had a half day or something like that to do the lesson or something. It was
there were
so many not good things about that for a course. But I was 100% confident because I knew everyone on the course. Everyone on the course was a maker or creative person. And so I didn't worry about ability. We made sure we were all safe. Those of whom found it easier than others sort of stepped back and let some have more experience and all that kind of stuff. And we taught enough so that everyone got to have a go. I was definitely not a good teacher. Raz, I'd love for you and Heidi to come back and me to sort of give you what is now the lesson that I would teach so that you can sort of feel and hear the difference. Yeah. Not, you know, mind you, like you say, 2019 to now is long enough. You probably don't really remember.
No, but I remember the fact that you made us feel confident about using the turning tools and the lathe.
Yeah.
And yeah, like you said, from a technical perspective and the amount of skill you now have at teaching, it might have been a terrible class. But I think it was an excellent setting for us to get introduced to the lathe and also an excellent occasion for you to get introduced to teaching it.
Yes. Yeah. No, it was definitely invaluable for me from that point of view. And one of the other people there who didn't actually take part, but they observed the lesson, they did pull me to one side afterwards. And my ego was suitably inflated when they said that I was a very good teacher and that I should seriously considering doing more of it. And that does make a difference. I brushed it off because I'm British and we don't take compliments very well. But it definitely led on to me willing to do more of that. But it's interesting as well. You talk about syllabus. So, and Heidi mentioned an experience earlier. There's definitely sort of 3 different things or type of an event you can teach. One is definitely an experience. So I would argue that tends to be 1 to 3 hours normally,
yeah.
Maybe what you'd call a full day. And again, a full day doesn't have to be a full day. Like if you tell someone they're doing a full day's blacksmithing, for instance, and it's going to start at 8:30 and end at 5, I think you're going to scare some people away. For us, for instance, the full day course that I teach in wood turning is 10 till 4 and has an hour break for lunch. Okay, so by the end of that, I can assure you, I am mentally exhausted enough that that's been a full day for me as a teacher.
Mm.
And all of the students have finished the projects they need to, and they've gone on their way. So an experience, if you're giving an experience, they're not necessarily setting out to finish a project on an experience. Maybe they are. It's good to work out what people want right from the beginning. The main thing for that is about being safe and getting people to have a go and see whether they like the craft that you're teaching.
Or maybe just to get them comfortable around the tools.
Yes.
For some people, and I have a lot of them, they have not done any really crafty things beforehand.
Yeah.
So just getting them accustomed to the fact of using their hands and creating something can be more than enough of an experience. Experience? Yeah. That's the word.
Experience. Yeah, you're doing well. It's fine.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm barely speaking today.
I wouldn't worry about it. There are Geordies and Glaswegians out there who wouldn't understand a word you're saying at any point in time. You wouldn't understand them either.
I wouldn't want to.
So if you've got an experience, then the sort of very similar to that is a fun session.
Mm.
And I think it's this is something that I think both of you mentioned that, you know, if you've got the space and you've got the equipment, running a small session that safely for parties, groups of people, maybe Rasmus has mentioned groomsmen coming along to forge something together. You can certainly do an event that is fun and as informative as they want it to be. But I think it's just important. You just need to set out what the goal of the event is beforehand. And, you know, it doesn't have to be a smart goal or anything like that. It'd just be, oh, you want to have an hour and you want to hit some hot steel, or you want to just get muddy covered in the clay, or, you know, you want to make some shavings. That's fine. We can do that. That's not a problem. If you want to finish a piece, if you want a piece that you're going to take home, that's a different experience. But it's knowing that beforehand. And then, you know, the final one would be an actual lesson. You know, people want to start learning a skill set. They are coming away with something. I had a customer come into the shop this week saying, oh, my wife bought me a voucher for a beginner's wood turning experience, but I want to do the bowl course. And I said, that's great, but we don't offer that until you've done the first day, because the skill set required requires the first day. Now, technically, that's not 100% true. But if I'm teaching four people at once, I need to know that they're on a similar level of knowledge and understanding. And like you said, Rasmus, being around the tools, they're comfortable with the tools. They've done it a little bit before, so that I can kind of give a bit more attention to each person individually for a slightly more complex thing. Now, I've been talking far too much at this point, so I'm going to pick something else from our list of things, all of which are relevant to this job, and try and frame it into a question and not just keep using filler talk like I am at the moment. Have we spoken about being willing to share the space?
No, we haven't gotten into that yet.
Lovely. Heidi, would you want to do that? Because I think you mentioned it in the pre-show.
Sure. Well, as we know, I now have a larger space, but I have yet to...
It's very clean and lovely.
Yeah, I have yet to have anyone else in my space other than my son. When I was in this room that we're videoing, if you're watching this on video and not just listening, I did have a couple of opportunities to teach one-on-one, but it was hard because, like, you're tripping all over yourself and them. And when you're throwing and you've got a teacher, they want to be able to, like, 360 around the wheel and see what your hand position is and where you might be struggling a little bit and getting uneven walls. So this space wasn't really conducive to that. But then I've got the space now that I'm not really wanting to share. and I think that's mainly because it's not that I don't want people in the space. It's that I don't want people to take ownership of the space. So if I'm looking at teaching someone long-term, say they really want to learn the craft and they want to be able to come and go as they please. They want to have their own shelf space. They want to have their own wheel, whatever. That's not really going to work for me in the space that I'm in right now. And I have kind of come to terms with that a bit. So the path that I'm thinking from a teaching perspective wouldn't be a long-term teaching contract with anybody. It would just be more experiential. So say you've always wanted to try and throw on the wheel, you've never done it before, I could give you that experience and then you can leave me alone. Versus, like, really cementing some kind of relationship as, like, a master and apprentice situation. Yeah. But I think that's probably one of the key questions that you have to ask yourself when you are approaching teaching. Like, do you want to share your space? Do you want to share your time? Do you want to share your material? Because they're probably not going to come in with all of the equipment and all of the clay or the wood or whatever. So you have to be willing to part with material.
Yeah.
When it comes to time, like, I'm already strapped for time because I'm working full time and I have this business and I have a son who now joined Cub Scouts and I have a husband that I like to spend time with when we actually have, you know, a schedule that works. So that all kind of plays in. If I were full time, if I were to dump the full time job and go full time as a potter, it's definitely an area that I would have to be willing to sacrifice my space.
Yeah.
And share it either with an individual or a group of people. But for now, I don't have to do that, so I'm not going to.
I think there's definitely a lot of things we can unpack there. And one of them that you flagged up was the fact that, you know, if you're teaching groups and you're sharing that space, I hadn't considered this before, but I'm really happy to teach because it's not my workshop. Like, it is a space dedicated to teaching. It is set aside for that purpose. They're not my tools. They're not my lathes. It's not my timber. I'm getting paid for my time anyway. So I haven't got that kind of level of ownership of my own space and going, oh, they're touching the things. Stop touching the things. They're not part of the dedicated for you things to not touch. But also, and this is something you must find a bit frustrating, Rasmus, or maybe not because you're a bit happier the person generally than I am. having to move your workshop around from production setup to then doing a teaching setup. Like if you're in the middle of making a load of stuff for a market and then you've got a one-day lesson and you've got to shift everything around to make space, that takes more time. And that can be frustrating, particularly if you've found that sweet spot of, oh, this is in exactly the right locations for me to do the three processes to make this thing. Mm. And you know you've got another 40 to make the next day or whatever, and they're not in that sweet spot anymore. And it doesn't matter what you do, they're not going to be.
I think I end up doing so many different things that I don't have like the perfect workshop anyway.
Okay.
Because like one day I'll be making roses, the next day I'll be making nails, and then I'll be making knives, and then I'm making axes. And I need to rearrange my anvil or my anvils and the tooling I use and make sure like, oh, I'm doing forge welding. Right. I need this forge and I'm doing big billets. I need it close to the power hammer. So I need to move things around anyway. Now for me, this is really nice. Like the combination of having a large enough workspace where I have the possibility of moving things around as needed also makes it so that it's really easy for me to make it set up so that I can do the teaching.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the whole tool thing, like, yeah, it's the same thing for me. And in blacksmithing, it's a big tradition. You don't give anyone else your hammer. So I have ended up making like teaching sets of all of the tools that we will be using during the classes, mostly because I don't want the students to use my tools and then break them. Mm. And then I need to spend important time out of my next work week to make sure I can use the tools again before I actually get to make the things that make me money. So instead, I make duplicates of everything. I make a lot of them and I have a lot of them available. And every once in a while, I use those tools because now I'm doing a big batch of stuff and maybe tools will get too hot and having extra spare a set of tongs, extra drifts and punches, I can just swap those around and I will not break any of them. But if you start giving your tools to students, you will very quickly be impressed by how they can fuck things up.
So I've got a slightly different take on this and this is, I found this interesting. So although I work for a company that sells tools and equipment and timber and everything else, the tools that I teach with in the wood turning room have all been donated by the manufacturers.
Oh.
So you've got five sets of turning tools that technically 10 sets, because we've got two different types of sets from each. Anyway, now I say donated, that realistically is what's happened. They have a knowledge of how many they've given to us and the fact they're going to be used, but they write them off as marketing because we teach five courses a month and that's a minimum of four students per course. Well, you know, technically a minimum of two students per course, but if all the courses are full, that's four to five students per course, you know, so that's at least, let's say 20 people a month, maybe 25, depending on the courses, all of whom are getting hands-on with their tools. And then are in an environment where there's a shop to buy those tools.
Yeah.
So it's creating brand loyalty and familiarity before the person's even bought a lathe. I wouldn't strongly recommend, but I would suggest no matter what your craft is, if you get serious about your teaching journey and you get to a point where there is dedicated teaching space, either of your own or, you know, you rent it or whatever, I wouldn't be too backward about coming forward to companies that make the tools you like that you already use and say, hey, this is me. I teach X amount of courses across the year. This is what we do. These are the tools I always use. Is there some sort of deal we can work? Don't go straight in and go, will you give me the tools? But is there some sort of deal we could use that, you know, helps me to promote your brand? And, you know, and all that, the kind of the buzzwords and that kind of thing. Maybe not so much now as they would have done in the past, but I think you'd be surprised to see how many companies are willing to help out, you know, those people who are championing their tools already without getting paid to do so. And I know that's kind of an aside from where we were talking about, but it's still a relevant thing because tools and equipment You know, like, I wouldn't lend my personal tools out to someone I didn't trust either. Raz, you quite rightly said you've made other tools and equipment. Heidi, if you were teaching a group, I very much doubt that, most of your tools are your pair of hands, so you're not going to lend those. But, you'll have your favorite kind of shapers and scrapers and whatever.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as a potter, you've got shaping tools other than your hands. Like, there are more expensive ones that I wouldn't share. There are ones that I've fashioned specifically for some kind of texturing or some shape that I'm trying to get at. So those would be, mine and mine alone. But I think when it comes to wear and tear in your studio, like, they're going to use my wheel. That's no big deal. Like, they can't hurt it really, unless they like decided to like throw it against the wall or something, which is very heavy. And I don't think they can do that. Who knows what adrenaline can do, but I think just from a space perspective, they might, bump into something and break something. Or one thing that in a public studio that you have to worry about is people using the wrong clay, people using the wrong type of glaze, people not applying their glaze correctly and it running and getting all over your shelves, people applying glaze to the bottom of pieces and then the glaze melts and attaches your piece to your shelf. Those are all things that people that have studios that are open have to contend with. And you really do have to plan what to do in those cases. Like, do you charge for somebody to fill up the kiln? Do you charge somebody for a shelf in the kiln? Do you charge somebody for per unit of clay? So like those kind of wear and tear situations specifically, I think to the kiln is probably the more expensive risk that you're up against if you aren't there the whole time. Like if you have an open studio situation where somebody can just come in and do whatever they want, give you their piece and say it's ready to go, and you put it in the kiln and it explodes or it melts everywhere or whatever because they didn't understand the science enough. Part of that's on you as the teacher, but part of it also is just the risk you take when you open your tools to be used.
Can I jump?
Pottery always sounds so much scarier out of the three of these things.
It's like, because of explosions.
It's the one where it could potentially be the one that people think is the most soft and kind of like, whatever, at least scary. But compared to blacksmithing, where you can see if the problem's going to happen, or like, wood turning where it's like, oh, it's come off the lathe. You don't even notice it. It's either gone past you or it's hit you. But, the fact that there's potential for your piece to just explode and this pressure cooker of heat. Anyway, sorry, Raz, I cut you off.
I just wanted to jump back a bit on the whole tooling situation. Because, and what you were mentioning about having the lathes from the manufacturer given to you. To your workplace
the
to
tools,
use.
Not the lathes. Very, very clear.
Okay,
tools,
yeah, sorry.
Not the lathes.
Okay, sorry. But that is something I have ended up doing as well, where I've started to retail the heat treating ovens and the belt grinders, which is what I started with. And then as I keep teaching more people and people see I'm selling some tools, well, are you selling more tools? And every once in a while, people are like, I like this anvil. Can I keep this anvil? And then I figured out how to just find more anvils. And now I have anvils people can come and pick up and buy from me, or I can ship them to them, which is also a big thing. Like, this is such a big chunk of steel. A lot of people don't know how to package things for sending on pallets and don't want to deal with all of that. And also for some people, an anvil is so heavy, you need two people to pick it up. If you have a traveling anvil at 130 kilos for a couple of years, that is less of a problem, at least while I'm still young and vaguely healthy. But then I started to branch out. I started to get more materials in so that people can come to me and buy stuff that they want and need to do the craft I'm teaching. And because I'm already the authority figure in the teaching situation, people trust my opinion. When I say like, I bought these belt sanders because I used the hell out of one for years. And that's why I trust them to be the one I sell here in Norway.
Yeah.
And the same goes for the quality of steel, the type of tongs. I like, I can explain why I choose this thing specifically. Whereas if you go to someone who's only doing the retail, they might just be thinking about which one they got the most margin on.
Yeah.
But I don't have the option. Yeah. I just have, this is the thing.
Yeah. And I've definitely found that students returning to the shop will come and specifically seek me out to ask my opinion on, you know, I'm looking to do this now. What do I need? What is there a new tool? Is there a different abrasive? Is there a different technique? Is there some form of product that would help me with this? And you're definitely right. And if I was doing more teaching from home and it wasn't conflict of interest with the day job, I would be doing the same as you and going, well, hey, actually, do you know what? I keep a small stock of, you know, maybe I go to car boot sales and I buy the secondhand tools that I can then just polish up a little bit so that I get a profit margin. Or maybe I would contact a company and ask to be a representative for them and keep a small stock, or whatever the case may be. It's definitely, we've spoken in the past about having different revenue streams. And yes, teaching in and of itself could potentially be a good revenue stream, but it's the willingness as well to recognize that people will, if you do it right, people will trust your judgment. And as you said, Rasmus, will see you as an authority figure. And it's very important you make it clear that you are not the authority figure, but you know, you might be slightly above them in knowledge, but not necessarily be all and end all. And it's a good way, if you're that way inclined and you are trying to make a go of it as a business, having stock of things that people want.
If it's just like you say, you're constantly already going to flea markets and car boot sales and things like that, because you're looking for tools to supplement the collection you have.
Yeah.
But then you know that, oh, I have a collection of students rotating in and out over the year. Well, here's a good deal on these chisels, these gouges. Like, here is a decent lathe that someone is now getting rid of. Yeah. I have the room to store it. Okay, I'll pick it up. I know the community. Like, I can pass that on.
You have the space to store it, right?
No, I don't anymore. That's the problem.
You have bunches of friends who are weirdly willing to have pallets full of anvils and post vices stored at their locations.
Not anymore. I have
for those listening around who are working out of a spare room, and having to pack stuff away in between. This conversation is possibly something for you to think about in the future.
I'm not going to apologize, though.
No, it's just jealousy. It's just jealousy, Raz. Don't worry about it. But it's definitely, you know, it's all of these things you can consider. And we've hinted at this a little bit. Let's talk about pricing. I was shocked to find out. So the place where I work also has a shop that sells, it's called the Arts and Crafts Shop, and it primarily focuses on sewing, knitting, crochet, and painting supplies. And they started running some courses, and I was like, well, this will be really good. This should be a really good revenue stream for you. And they said, no, it's really not. And I said, what are you talking about? And they said, well, a 3-hour course, they can't charge for, or even a full day course, sorry, so the 10 till 4, because there are so many people teaching sewing, crochet, and knitting,
right?
Certainly in the local area, and they're doing it from home at, you know, with no overheads. £60 per person for a day is the average cost for either a sewing, knitting, or crochet course for a full day. Now, just to put that into perspective, £60 per day, that's per person. Let's say they can take 5 people. So you've got to provide materials, you've got to provide access to, you know, the power for the sewing machine, all that kind of stuff. You've got a lot of overheads plus the space. If you're not yourself the tutor for that, and you were paying for a tutor, that's not a lot of money, okay?
No.
In a direct comparison, for 5 people for the full day for one of my courses, it's £135 per person, okay? Mm. Now, we include lunch, but okay, let's knock £20 off. So that's £115. Yes, that includes the materials. They get to keep the item that they make at the end of it, and we'll speak about that in a moment. That includes the power, that includes the paying me for the teaching, that includes the, you know, electricity and all that kind of stuff. But there's still a reasonable profit margin in that. And that's not, you know, if we've looked around throughout the whole country and we've looked at a one-day beginner's course and we've gone, right, we're not the most expensive and we're not the cheapest, we're about here. Also, we check that every year and it goes up slightly every year, because of inflation rates and costs to power and everything go up every year. So, you know, pricing is definitely in there. You've got to bear that in mind. But my strongest thing with that would be look around and see what other people are charging. And not just one person and not just in your area. Look for the whole country and just, you know, Google it and see what people are charging. What do you reckon, Heidi? Would that make sense to you? Or
yeah, I mean, if you want it to be profitable, yes. obviously, you want to make sure that you're within whatever the economy can support.
Yeah.
The other thing is that the whole exercise of trying to determine what type of teaching you're doing mm-hmm. will help set the price point. So if you're just doing like a, hey, let's sit at the pottery wheel and make, you know, something you can't even take home, that entry level cost may be quite a bit less.
Yes.
Versus if you were doing a full month workshop where, you know, you're helping them maintain their piece the whole way through. And at the end, they end up with like multiple pieces or one really amazing finished good that, you know, they've built their skill level up during that month. So your costing might be higher because it's more of a commitment for you. You're not able to schedule other classes around it because your space is filled because their work is there for a long period of time. Those are the considerations that you have to make. But also there's opportunity for value adds, right? And I think Rasmus, you may have talked about this in previous episodes where you start off beginner's classes and maybe offer a coupon for returning people or people that bring more people in for the beginner's class, but then they take a advanced level class. Those are places where you can kind of offset some of your costs where at an entry, it's almost like drug dealing, right? Like you bring them in with a little bit of enticement with some like low level drugs and then you get them addicted. It's really a terrible analogy.
I have to threaten my boss all the time by saying that at work and people come in and say, oh, you know, I don't need anything today. And I'm like, we don't sell anything anyone needs in here. We are completely drug pushers. This is like, well, you know, come and try one of these. Your first experience is free over here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there's like, you don't always have to use your own space either.
No.
Like you might get offered an opportunity to be a visiting artisan to work at a existing shop like Dan, you kind of do in a way, but there are campuses like college campuses that invite working artists to come and teach maybe a semester. And there are opportunities there where you can segue that into something like you could do traveling workshops where maybe you're going to somebody's business and setting up and doing just a, not even a hands-on workshop. All you're doing is showing what you're doing. They can film it. And it's just a demonstration. And then you're piggybacking that with like, I have a contract with this lathe tool supplier and you can take one of my coupons and that'll get you, you know, whatever you need. But then there's also, you don't have to do in-person teaching. You can do online teaching, which we learned a lot about during the pandemic.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun for me to do online sessions. You forgot about the pandemic?
No. I'd completely forgotten about the Virtual Craft Festival and all of that kind of stuff. Even though I was able to do two sessions. Sorry, that definitely is a thing. And Heidi, I want you to talk more about that in a second. But having to realize that you can do online teaching, you could just film yourself doing a thing and upload it to a separate website, or you can do it live streaming it and whatever, which is a lot of what Heidi was doing. How did that come about, Heidi? I know it's kind of a slight segue, but it's still relevant.
Who reached out to me?
Was it Jamie
Page may have, or one of the other people that were organizing it. I'm pretty sure it was Jamie. So it started out as just for wood turners. And mainly because a lot of wood turners would travel and showcase their skills and work with local turning people like organizations and all that stuff, men's clubs and those kind of things in different countries. And because of COVID, it meant that they lost that opportunity for revenue. And it just gave, I think it was a great service to a lot of us who couldn't go to shows anymore for that period of time, who weren't getting that social interaction too. But it also gave us an opportunity to hone our skills at being able to speak about our craft in a way that introduced people to it, but also showcased our abilities. because you were demoing what you were doing, not only from a, hey, if you've never seen anybody throw on a wheel before, here's what that looks like. So each consecutive time, I would like up the ante with what I was going to throw.
Yeah.
Teaching, I think, is a really accelerated way to improve you as a maker, as a skilled artisan or craftsperson, because it makes you think about what you're doing in a little different way. For me, when it was filming what I was doing, not only did I have a recording of myself so that I could take a look and see, like, what in my technique can I improve? Am I educating in a way that makes sense when I talk through what I'm doing as I'm doing the steps? And if someone else were sitting at the wheel and not me, could I narrate what they were doing? Doing kind of like a play-by-play? Would I be able to do that? And being able to like hop in on other people's lessons and be able to kind of like ask them questions while they were working helped to kind of spur on those kind of conversations to talk through why am I using this tool right now? Or why did I start with that measurement of clay? Or, you know, why do I have my wheel going at this certain rate of speed while I'm doing this activity on it? I think if you don't have the space to invite people into your location, but you still want to hone your ability to teach, virtual teaching is great. You can record it, save it, and sell those courses later. Or you can just use that as promotional material. You can clip those little snips of you doing certain things and use that as opportunity to bring people into your space. You can share that on your table while you're selling in person. So like you've got that playing in the background. People can see you actively doing your craft and understand that like those things that are on those shelves were for sure made by the maker that's standing in front of you right now. Yeah. So those are like all the things that I will continue to like celebrate with the fact that we have this technology available to us.
Yeah.
Can I jump in just on the filming things? I'm terrible at taking pictures and photographs. Like this is getting a bit more of the marketing of the classes, but it triggered something that I suddenly realized that some of the students told me a while back. And that is some students like to film you demonstrating the thing so they can look back at it later when they're in their own workshops. That in itself might feel like they're stealing more knowledge than what you intend to give them. I don't think that, but not only is it like you are actually giving them the knowledge, ideally, no matter how they choose to retain that, even if that's recording the whole session of it, I think that's fine. But also because I have had students share that with other people and go like, look how good he is. You should go take a class with him.
Yeah.
And I realized that, like, so I do very little marketing of the classes themselves, like what we're doing, how fun we're having, the people taking them. I try to take a few pictures. It looked kind of cool when I jump up on a welding table. All students are busy forging. No one is noticing I'm taking a picture. Like, I really like that moment. I might get one or two of those during the whole weekend where I remember to take that picture and it's happening. And I might use that like as a cover image on my website for like to cover the concept of classes. But the student themselves being psyched, they take pictures, they are on Snapchat, on Instagram and sharing their stories. That is all the marketing I need outside of my newsletter and me just mentioning on stories on Instagram that I am doing classes. But then you kind of need to be comfortable with them taking all of this content, recording you doing things and putting that out there.
You also need your students to be of an age range where that comes naturally to them.
I've had people up in their late 60s that wants to film what I'm doing are sharing it.
That's the youngest group of people who come and learn wood turning.
Well, yeah, that's a fair point.
So... and that's not to downplay anything you've said at all, Raz. And it is probably just because of where they're getting the lesson. It tends to be that age group of people. I know that there are others around who get a lot more younger students.
But I'm saying you can use this as a tool as well. You can say, yes. Like, so this is a technically difficult concept. If you want to, please record this.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they are doing the marketing for it, even if they're not all that apt with all of the whole social media thing. Mm-hmm. Most people have a smartphone and they know how to turn the camera on. And if nothing else, they have learned from the grandkids how to film them. All right.
That's genuinely not something I'd ever considered. And that's a really, really good point, actually, is you know, you can't, like with everything we make, you can't replace what you've just done. Like if I'm hollowing out a bowl, I can't put the wood back and do it again.
Yeah.
You know, if you're, you know, yours is possibly the closest, Raz, to be able to like flatten something out and then hammer it out again. But it's still not quick and easy to do.
Yeah, to some extent.
So to say to people right from the get-go, look, you know, this is going to be a watch this, film this. You can watch it back and whatever, that's fine. You know, show it to your friends. Yeah.
The problem, though, people then get so preoccupied with filming that they might not be paying attention to what you're saying.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of a trade-off there. But I think it is, to some extent, it is worth mentioning. Also for those things where like they can just vaguely point the camera in your direction and look past it and they can still get information, but they have that timepiece, so to speak, on their phone.
You just want the students filming your ass as you're smashing hot steel and getting the sparks going. You want your fortune fire moment here, Rasmus. Calm down, man. Come on. You've got a girlfriend now.
In my defense, if they're filming my arse when I'm forging, they can't see what I'm doing.
I'm going to leave that there. That's a whole other range of conversation there. But it's absolutely true.
I'm seeing exactly what they want to see.
There's definitely a thought process there that we should all embrace the fact that whilst we are trying to teach historical and traditional crafts, we're able to have this conversation about this now through the modern technology.
Yeah.
Most people have got it in their pocket. So let them use it and encourage them to use it, like you said, Raz, like in a manner that's not going to be detrimental to them paying attention, and pick your moments with it. But I think that's definitely something I'm going to start exploring in future lessons, because like you say, it's also a really good passive marketing technique. You know, and someone go, what are you watching there? Oh, well, you know, I'm just watching my teacher do this. And like, what do you mean your teacher, et cetera, conversation carries on and goes from there. So no, I really like that.
I have one more.
Oh, no, hang on, you've crested now. This careful.
One of the things I did very early on, because I started to teach earlier than I probably should have,
mm-hmm.
and because I knew that I was lacking in the whole concept of how to convey the craft of blacksmithing, was that I started to write down the curriculum. I started to write out fairly detailed description of all of the concepts I wanted to cover in the class. And I gave that to the students a week beforehand.
Right.
Now, that's also something that I added on to for the first maybe 5 years. I would expand on that basically pamphlet before every single class. So it will grow and grow and grow. And then at some point when the pandemic hit, I basically realized that I have 50 pages of something that could be a book. Yeah. And that's something that I think keeps helping my classes sell. Because people are getting access to a wealth of information. And also it helps prepare the students. I only give it to them a week beforehand because I don't want them to actually read everything. I just want them to have access to some information and be able to skim through the beginning of it. Okay. So that when they show up, they have some knowledge and all of the things I say, they can also look back upon.
Okay, so because I know how much you love coming up with new products and ideas, how many of your original students have you gone back to and said, hey, do you want the latest version?
Oh, I haven't done that in 2 years, updated the book proper. But what I basically have done is I just send out a mass email to everyone who's... And also, like we talked about this a while back. I've been selling this book as working project on the website.
That's what I was going to say. Is it a product available for sale on your website?
If so...
Then obviously sending your mail out on, hey, the updated version, like whatever is on there.
No, I'm giving it to them. Everyone who signed up for the class, I'm giving it away.
Yes, because they've paid for the class. But you've also got people who won't have done. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but no, everybody who's taken the class and everybody who's bought that an old version of the book, I have their email address and I'll just send out, this is the recent version.
Okay.
And I'll add on and say like, hey, if you're interested in more classes, we are doing more advanced stuff now.
Yeah.
And I'm reminding them, this is me using the reason I have your email address. The reason I want to give this to you is also a way of marketing more of the things I'm doing now.
So you've created a continuous conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was about to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. And that has meant that you're able to then say, and by the way, I now sell X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, because like some people
I'm going to hate myself for saying it, Rasmus, but did anyone tell you that you're actually occasionally quite clever and that's possibly why you're succeeding so well in your small business on your own?
Nah, I don't trust it.
I'm going to let you run with this, Heidi, because I could see your brain whirring at that and doing the same as mine and going, damn it. Like, yeah.
I wasn't that clever when I started out. It just happened to be something. Well, I sold it as a work in progress. And now it has progressed. So I'm giving you kind of what you paid for. You paid a less smaller price because you took a gamble on this. You supported me writing more. So I'm giving back. And I want this to be a hardcover book in some at some point.
We
and
know I'm you betting, do. How long have you been carrying on writing that?
Shut up. Different conversation. And I'm gambling on that a lot of the people who bought the ebook would want to have the physical copy. So I'm just reminding them that, no, this is still going on. This is coming out in a while. Sorry, Heidi.
I love that you're doing that because like Dan was saying, it's like a continual conversation, but it gives you opportunity to remind people that you are still there and you're still offering classes. So if they had a really good time, like, hey, by the way, this thing that you already paid for is paying off in dividends because you can revisit what you learned during the first class and possibly sign up for another. It's really great. I buy a lot of books from people that I like what they're doing. And that's another teachable opportunity. Writing manuals for certain steps in the process. It can be as small as like the one book that I just purchased. I don't want to become an advertisement, but the one book that I just purchased is how to create molds of just closures. So you can do like twist on, twist off caps for pottery, and you do like slip casting molds. I probably will never do it, but understanding that it's a process that can be done, and you know what problems this potter found as he was developing the technique. It's a really short little, like maybe 50-page paperback book that you can buy a physical copy, which I like physical books so that I can take notes in the margins because I'm, 43 and I'm okay with that. But he also sells a digital version of it that he updates on a regular if like he learns some new technique or whatever. But I've also bought other potters books that service as kind of like a biography about who they are as a potter and how they became a potter and what their belief system is with clay and, you know, why they choose to do certain things with clay, why they choose to sell things the way that they do and what community they're trying to build around them. But also like the book serves as a portfolio of their work, which is really interesting because I can flip through and say like, ooh, I really want to try this technique. I see what they're doing there. And you can kind of gain some inspiration from those books. But as writing the books, you can provide that learning opportunity and provide that inspiration for those people looking for it. So I think that there are like, there's a million different ways of teaching.
Yeah.
There's a million different opportunities to create a legacy for yourself in your craft. And it's, I think, just like it is like developing your craft, like jumping in, if your personality is risk averse and you want to know everything about what you need to do to get into something, be prepared that if you're interested in teaching, you're going to behave the same way that you behaved when you started your craft.
Yeah.
If you're risk averse, if you jump feet first into it, be prepared to fail and learn through failing. Like Rasmus was saying, maybe he was a little green to be teaching, but if you're honest with where you are at and your skill level and not trying to pretend to be a master when you're not, I think more people are apt to be like, actually, I want to learn with you. There's still people that are going to be below your level where you can take your skill level and be able to say like, okay, this is what I've learned so far in my journey. Would you like to know what I know? And that's completely okay. You don't have to be this like amazing, like world renowned, whatever.
Yeah.
You can just say like, hey, this is what I've learned. I've invested 200 hours into this thing that I'm very passionate about. Would you like to learn about it? If so, you know, join me for a class. If you would like to learn with me, I'll take you on in my studio and we can learn together. And maybe you can you know, clean up the studio and I'll teach you what I know and you can get some space with me. So like, there's just, it's like phenomenal how much we could probably talk about all the different things that you can teach.
There's one aspect to that that you've both brought up that I'd forgotten about that I really do want to hammer home. And that is, I know how much better I have gotten as a wood turner through teaching. Okay. And I don't mean, oh no, I've got to practice more because I've got a class tomorrow. There's an element of that, but it's learning how to explain a process to someone in like 10 different ways so that you can explain it to anyone. The only way you can do that is by you really breaking down the process yourself, by watching masters do the process, having them explain it to you, reading about it, looking at all the different things, and then going, oh, this thing that I always did this way, actually, if I like twist my hand this way, or if I shift my body weight that, all of a sudden it's now 20% easier to do this. Great. So I can now do this quicker and easier and whatever. How do I communicate that to other people? And I don't know about you guys, but I've started to get a slight reputation at work in that I'm, as I've mentioned in the past, very hot on efficiency and trying to do things to a consistent standard, but faster. And I've started doing that with my lessons. So it's actually got to a point now where the 10 till 4 lesson with five people, which when I first started teaching that, maybe drifted slightly past the 4 o'clock mark. If I have a student who is not finished by 3:30, it's unusual.
Wow.
Okay. So we're now at the point where it's not that I'm teaching them necessarily that they're better, but I have realized, hey, do you know what? This period of time I had for an hour to give them all to do this really basic task, actually they start getting fatigued at 45 minutes. So I don't need to give them an hour. They if they've not got that concept in that 45 minutes, it doesn't matter because they're going to do that again later on. So we can shave 15 minutes off that section. I can now dump that over here, which means they develop better at this. And you start playing and it allows breathing room so that if you've got some students who are all that slightly higher level, you can go, oh, great, we can now teach you a slightly more advanced technique. We can possibly add color or texture in or something like that. Or if you've got a group that are really struggling to get it and they're all at that same level again, you can take more time. And that's something that I've definitely found has, because I've learned more about the different ways of doing things, and I'm still way, way off being able to ever claim that I'm a master, let alone a grandmaster. It's certainly helped me, and it's shoved me a lot further along than I would have been if I decided to never teach and I was just sort of pottering around in my workshop at home and occasionally having a lesson with someone. So I can't explain enough the value of doing that. And the other value of that is getting feedback. And that's the final thing. And that's what we're going to wrap up on. This is like, it's all very well having people come around for an experience or a lesson or whatever they're doing. If at the end of that period of time with you, they politely say, oh yeah, thanks, that was great, and maybe shake your hand or walk off, and there isn't any follow-up feedback, it's really difficult to know whether or not they actually meant that. Now, if you want to go down the route or you're working for a corporation, they might ask you to provide a paper or digital form for someone to physically fill out and, you know, what are the things, you know, whatever. But a really important question to ask everyone is, I find the two questions I always ask is, one is, did everyone have fun? Okay, regardless of whether or not you finish a project, did you have fun? Great. Hopefully the answer to that question is yes. The second one is, what would you like us to do if we can improve the course to make it better for you in any way? And more often than not, the question that we fear is going to be, oh, well, you could teach this in a different way. That's unlikely to come back. Most often it's normally, but quite often it comes back as things like, oh, the room was too cold, or the room was too hot, or could we have a break in the mid-morning for tea? Or could, you know, it's the little things. And don't dismiss them, because they are important. But that tends to be the things that people are bothered by. But that will also be the thing that, if they were going to leave you a digital review somewhere, would knock a star off. Because it's that, those little humanity things where they're like, oh, I was cold the whole day, so I couldn't really enjoy me. I couldn't relax properly and all that kind of thing. Very important to ask for feedback. You will get positive as well as negative, but I would always say, don't take it personally. because everyone's got their own differing opinions on things. And you will know right from the get-go whether someone or not is like gelling with you as a person and whether or not they're really, you know, is the class going well for them or not. And I would argue that your role as a teacher is to give everyone their own room, but make sure that everyone enjoys the experience and it does it safely. Whether or not they learn anything or not, whatever it is you're teaching, make sure they feel that they've got value for money if you're charging for that experience.
Can I ask a different question?
Go on, Raz.
Just, have you made mistakes when teaching?
Yes.
100%. And I mean, the question isn't about how, if you have, it's how you deal with it. Something I did when I was teaching using Coalforge is I will burn my piece because a student asks a question, I get distracted, and then suddenly I have a glowing, sparkling stick of steel and a melted blob in the bottom of the forge. I was like, oh, shit. Okay, that's not supposed to happen, but that's why you don't get distracted. Like, how do you deal with that? I have also from like learning from Steve, who often will get distracted, it's to own the mistake. Like, say, yeah, that's why you shouldn't take your eyes off the steel when it's in the forge. You should keep an eye on it. You should be purposeful with how you place it, all of these things. And people usually tend to appreciate the fact that I am able to make mistakes as well, and that I then tell, okay, here's what I did wrong.
Yeah.
But have you had like those learning moments for you in the forge or in the workshop, so to speak?
The only time I've ever gone through the bottom of a bowl is when I've been teaching. And I've done it twice.
Right. Yeah.
Because you're the portion of my brain that would normally be concentrating and checking and whatever is spent telling everyone what I'm doing.
Mm.
And so you're focusing and you're talking about right, and then you drop your hand here and then you do this. And so it becomes this kind of piece of wood when you're forgetting about the fact that this is getting thinner. But each time, because you can hear the change, I've known that I've got close. And then you've gone, right, we're going through the bottom of the bowl, because that doesn't mean that the bowl comes flying off the lathe. It's, if you know what you're doing, it can still be quite safe. But the students don't know what's about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got just enough period of time, the same as when you can see that the metal has been left in the forge for too long. Mm-hmm. Right, teaching moment. So what we're going to do now, and for those of you worried about going through the bottom of the bowl, donk, bit comes out. This is what happens. I'm not hurt. There's not really a problem. There's, you know, we can remove that fear. Let's take that fear away. Now let's enjoy ourselves.
Mm, I
so
like that,
that's for me, that's been kind of the ones where I've, the biggest, most obvious one to a student. I'll make other little mistakes when I'm like trying to make a shape or something, but I've done that enough that you can then go, and if that goes wrong, then we just do this, you know, yeah. And it's all just part of the patter. And so it seems natural. I'm fortunate, as many people will tell me, that I'm good at talking, or I like to talk, possibly is better a description rather than good at. So having done enough of it, then I've learned how to kind of manipulate the feeling of the situation, shall we say. Hmm. But yeah, I don't know about you, Heidi. I mean, I can only imagine what it'd be like if you're showing someone how to raise a vessel and then it just collapses in on itself and you kind of like, you've got that moment where it starts to wobble. And but I don't know if you've ever had that in teaching.
Yeah, I mean, there's a practice in teaching pottery where you force fail so that you can you can show recovery. Like, oh, if this happens, this is how you recover. If you have an air bubble, you might let someone come over and feel what that feels like while the wheel is turning so that they can understand like, okay, well, when there is an air pocket or there's like some harder clay because you didn't wedge well enough, this is what it feels like. Again, like your situation of being less intimidated by the failure.
Yeah.
But like there's other potters out there that's specifically what they do in their first like 10 minute opening spiel of like how to center. Like, let's show you what happens when you're not centered and you pull your walls up. Mm-hmm. Let's show you how to correct after you've pulled your walls up and realize that you're not centered. Let's talk about failure, because pottery is 90% failure and 10%, you know, success. So
yeah.
It's definitely, I think with pottery, more than anything, it's made me a better teacher through those stressful moments where I know I'm not a perfect potter. I know I don't wedge well. I know that there are certain tricks that I've learned that help me kind of work through those areas that I'm not so good at, and embracing that and kind of talking through it definitely makes me more human and more approachable when, say, a student's having a harder time at learning how to throw, or having a harder time because their pieces are cracking during the drying process. Like, hey, you know, I think I pulled out one of my like really shitty early pieces and showed you like previously, like, this is what I used to make. And I just persevered through it. And I think if you can't acknowledge when you make a mistake, and you can't acknowledge that you are not a perfect craftsperson, you probably shouldn't be teaching, because then you're just an asshole, really, at the end of the day. You're just going to come across as an egotistical person who thinks that you're better than everybody else. And I don't think that you should be offered the respect of teaching. And that's just my soapbox, really.
I think that's the t-shirt for the series, that if you don't admit your failures, you're an arsehole. I think I think that's a good place to end today's episode. As Heidi said, we could talk about this subject for a long time.
I have notes we haven't gotten to.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you have. I mean, you know, there's always a possibility of a part two on the topic.
If people want us to.
Yes, give us feedback and let us know whether this has been long and drawn out or whether you want to continuously have it. I think now, I noticed on Spotify the other day that you can leave comments on Spotify now. I'll have to look into that. I doubt anyone's done that for us yet. Anyway, we're at that point, ladies and gentlemen, guys and girls, and those who are in between, where we can now talk about the fact that this is the end of the episode. We're going to have another one. We've not finished the season yet. If you would like to talk to any of us in between times, then there are a number of different ways you can do that. First of all, though, talking about support, talking about marketing, please tell other people about us. Please tell your friends about us. Please tell people who you don't think even would necessarily be interested in ever making something or selling something, but just tell them about this and say, hey, look, you know, this is a thing I like. Maybe you'll like it too. We'd always appreciate that. You know, comment and like and all those kind of good things on wherever you listen to the podcast. It does push things up ratings, get it more noticed in front of more people. If you should be so willing and so inclined to consider parting with some of your hard-earned cash, we do have a Patreon account. We currently have four lovely people who have subscribed on there. We will work on Patreon rewards. We keep saying this, but we will do it. And we will work on merchandise as well. That is something that we definitely need to do, because all three of us want new t-shirts and hoodies. So we will absolutely get that sorted. We should probably set a goal of that, let's say by New Year, maybe.
Try.
There we go. That's a nod from Heidi, and we can try from the Norwegian. So we're going to say by the New Year. I haven't said which year. We're going to say by New Year that we'll get some merch sorted. So that sounds good. But should you wish, no, I think it'll be fine. But should you wish to reach out and discuss with any of us, you can get us by email as a group, info@settingupshop.com. Don't forget to how to spell shop, SHOPPE. Should you wish to reach us individually, you can find me on Instagram @BevelwoodUK. You can find the group of us on Instagram @settingupshop. I can't remember whether it's got underscores between the words. Really should do. It's third season.
It does.
Should look. It does. There we go. Setting up shop, but with underscores in between. Heidi @WhitehallPottery and Rasmus @RasmusLowen, which I think is the first time I've got that right, because I wrote it down at the beginning rather than trying to remember at the end. So thank you very much, everybody. We hope you've enjoyed that. And we shall persevere with other subjects coming soon. And of course, some special guests. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, guys.